Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello. In last week's podcast, Rick Kennedy and I discussed the larger political and social events of the life of Cotton Mather, the subject of his new biography in The First American Evangelical, A Short Life of Cotton Mather. He's back this week to discuss Cotton Mather's ideas like Eleutherianism, to drop a little Greek, and the details of his daily life and practice. To start with that, Rick, one of the things that really that I liked very much is that there's a walking tour at the back of the a book of Cotton Mather's Boston. How did you decide to do that, and why did your publisher allow you to? I'm glad they did, but I'm just surprised.
Yeah, you know, we talked that back and forth. Here's the deal with Cotton Mather is first of all when my publisher David Bratt at Erdman's working in concert with Mark Knoll, you know, they asked me to do this, and I said to them I really didn't feel like I could or should, because I mean this is a very imposing thing. Robert Middlecoff had written Three Generations of Puritan Intellectuals, the Mather Family, in the 80s, yeah. And that got the Bancroft Prize, which for a historian is like the Oscar, man. This is big time. And then I had met Robert Middlecoff, and man, this is a very prominent, imposing figure. And then Kenneth Silverman in 1984, I think the paperback came out in 88, got the Pulitzer Prize for the biography of Cotton Mather in the 80s. And so, you know, I just felt like you can't ask me to do a biography. And they said, well, hey, this is going to be short. Okay, it's going to be short. And I said, okay, so it's a different market. It's a sort of different thing. It's not supposed to be, you know, I'm not supposed to be in competition with Robert Middlecoff and Kenneth Silverman, which made me feel a lot better. I mean, David Levin had also, from Stanford, had written this amazing biography of the young Mather and stuff. So I just felt like, oh, man, my book has to be really different. And the first and most important thing to me that made it different was geography. Really, the Middlecoff book was much more about theology. And the Silverman book, what made it so beautiful was it was about psychology. It was a sort of a deep study of this very quirky person, and in a way you use the diary as a type of psychoanalyst type of thing, and
Cotton Mather's resting on the pew while he's doing analysis kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And what I wanted to do was the pastor scholar, and it works. I mean, this is true. I mean, you go to visit north end of Boston, and this is Matherland. You know, this is every corner you turn, there's a reference, you know, in for a historian like me, to something in Mather's life or Mather's kids or Mather's father or Mather. And so it just became so geographical to me. That here's a pastor scholar who worked and walked this neighborhood every day, and this is what my biography is really about, is this a working pastor scholar who's very practical.
The North End is Boston is I love it because it's two of my favorite things, Italian Americans and colonial history, jammed in on top of each other. It's as if the in Philadelphia the Italian Americans had gone to live in Old City rather than in South Philadelphia, but the it has that feeling you get in a few places in America, not a lot of places in Europe where you feel almost the abyss. Well, I want to mix my metaphors. It's both. You feel the abyss of time, but also there's a layer cake effect. You go to, you know, all these things happen in the same place. Now it's a Paul Revere place. It's Freedom Trail, but you've got the Puritan, the Preacher Trail kind of there. But at the same time, it's...
There's a North End Historical Association. It's a very nice group of people. And we've talked about this, is they want to make the North End history about the Italian immigration. They want to get back to the colonial and the Mathers. They want to show all these different layers of North End history, which are all there. But the big tourist draw is this revolutionary history, which just so people march through with only the American Revolution in mind. And they're missing 300 years of history when they do that.
And they're passing up a really good espresso, too. So,
you know, just to back up into a broader context here about historiography, you know, one of the things that's really interesting in terms of material culture and stuff about urban, especially these sites like Williamsburg or even Rome itself in Italy, is the reason we love to go to these places and visit them the reason we can see the history in them is because they died to some extent. There was a great period of falling apart where no one really cared anymore about them. And so you don't build skyscrapers on the North End. You don't, it was sort of left to itself. And so the Italians moved in. And you have all this very interesting history to places that somehow died in history.
That's a really nice point. Williamsburg is exactly like that.
Thomas Jefferson hated Williamsburg, and he moved the capital away. And Williamsburg then just sort of died. William and Mary died. Then it gets revived by the Rockefeller money, and boy, it's a wonderful place to visit.
Yeah, and I've thought of that. I was thinking of that area as another of these multi-layered places. You've got at Jamestown, 1607, the place where the first British Empire begins, and at Yorktown in 1781, it ends, and they're just 12 miles apart. But the fact that tobacco died in the Tidewater meant that those were except for the battles of the Battle of Yorktown and Civil War, those are relatively undisturbed sites. Unlike, say, you know, the Battery Park area of Manhattan south of Wall Street. Okay, so describe what did the North End mean to Cotton? What did that place mean to him?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that during this sort of center point of Cotton's life, between the time when he's in his teenage years to a little bit before he dies, you know, 17 into the 17 teens, New York hasn't developed yet. Philadelphia hasn't developed yet. This is in the British Empire. It's the North End of Boston, which is the most dynamic spot. And so, for this very short period of time, about three decades, there's just this. Cotton Mather felt that he was at the center of things, okay, which you wouldn't have felt if you felt, you know, with John Adams and stuff like that. John Adams always had to go somewhere else to be at the center of things, you know. Cotton Mather didn't have to go anywhere else to be at the center of things. And then so the North End means that to him, and there's these ships that are coming, and there's this vibrant social life and all the different, you know, we talk about Puritan society as being rather sort of stratified and sedate, and we often think of it as a type of sort of rural village life or something, but, you know, the North End of Boston, once you get into the 1670s, is full of, you know, it's gambling and brothels, it's ship captains and sailors, and these sailors are often coming from all over the world with all their different ethnic, you know, foundations and stuff like that. So it's a very vibrant society, and right in the center of it stands Cotton's church. And so he feels... The church is called the Second Church of, you know, there's only Congregationalist churches at this point, and it's the Second Church of Boston, and it's called Old, it takes on the name Old North eventually, but when another New North is built.
for the famous, for those of you who remember Longfellow Paul Revere's ride, his church is that church with the lanterns and the belfry. Not to mention the revolution, but that's just, you know.
Well, actually, there's a sort of a spitting match in the North End, which you can get involved with if you go there if you want to. The Episcopal Church is called Old North, and the Mather Church is actually gone. You know, it was destroyed in the Revolution. So the Episcopal Church took on the name Old North after Mather's Old North had disappeared. So there is a sort of spitting match as to, in Longfellow's poem, which does make reference to possibly what was a real historical thing, is that there was this lantern held up in, but which church was it? It's a fight between the two churches.
We're not going to, let's not go there. That's going to get too ugly.
It's a fun little fit.
Yeah. So Old North Church, that's his church. Second, and is his father, was his father there or the other?
His father is what we would call it senior pastor and associate pastor, and his father is always senior pastor, and so Cotton Mather lives his life as an associate pastor. Increase dies, as you said the last time, he lives a long life, so Increase dies just 5 years before Cotton dies. And so it's only for 5 years of Cotton's life is he what we would call a senior pastor. He's an associate pastor, and he and his dad complement each other because his dad is this sort of big thinker, you know, and a sort of harsh thinker in many ways, a very powerful thinker in many ways. And so Cotton's job is much more the parish job. It's his job more to walk around the neighborhood. His job is to look after the youth group and the singing in the church and to make sure that sick people are being visited, and all of that sort of normal parish activity is the job of the associate pastor.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. We shouldn't think then that he's confined to his study or confines himself to his study. He's out walking the streets doing his pastoral visitations and so on.
Yeah, and then you always have to imagine the seasons of the year. You know, Boston is a very sort of powerful, it's got rigorous winters, and he gets out there and he writes actually sort of devotionals about how to stay pious in the winter and visits people in the winter and stuff. And then on the other hand, there's those hot summers, and so he's very much a seasonal guy out there wandering. He advocated riding a horse, and I wondered if he actually owned a stable in the North End, but I sort of doubt it. I think he would cross over the Charleston Ferry and then rent a horse in Charleston and go for he and his father both loved to go over to Charleston and then ride north into the woods above Charleston.
Did he travel much in his life? I gathered from the book that he did not, that Ipswich was about as far as he ever went.
No, you know, and he is not his father loved to aspire to go back to England and, you know, always wanted the grand stage of the world. And Cotton actually saw the grand stage of the world through his writings. He didn't travel much. For a couple decades of his life, he would take a summer vacation, 2 weeks, where he would go over and he'd ride from Salem up through Wenham, you know, where Gordon College is and Gordon Conwell Seminary is. He actually donated the land to build the first church there at what now is Gordon Conwell Seminary in Hamilton. And then he would go up to Ipswich and Essex and through there, and the people loved him in that region, and he would go there every year. But that's it. He was not a big traveler. He would go down to Plymouth. He would go on speaking tours, and so if you called him out to your church in Reading or out to Dorchester, he would show up. But those are all today. Those are just suburbs of Boston. They're just all, you know, within a 50-mile radius.
Yeah, he didn't really leave the commuter rail grid of modern Boston, basically. That's amazing. So that he's a North End guy. He's focused on the North End. He is affected by things that he can that happen in the North End, or that, as it were, he sees from his position in the North End. You discuss in some interesting detail the building of the Brattle Street Church, which happened when he was 36 or so, and what that meant for him. What did that symbolize? What was Brattle Street Church, and what did that symbolize for him?
Yeah. Well, you know, today there's all these skyscrapers that compete with each other in city skylines. Well, in the day of Cotton Mather, it was the church steeples that competed with each other, and the churches themselves. The church architecture was the finest architecture of the city. And in this new world that's coming with William and Mary, you know, there'd been this Christopher Wren had designed these wonderful churches after the Fire of London in 1660, and they had steeples, and they were auditory. They had these very interesting roofs and towers. Thomas Brattle, who was this very, very, very smart, a very, very interesting figure, who's about 4 or 5 years older than Cotton, and never gets along with Cotton. They went to school together. They were at Harvard together. They spent their lives together, but they had an awkward relationship. But Thomas Brattle aspired to this sort of greatness of the science and architecture and literature of London, and so Brattle, being very rich, built a new church, which was needed. I mean, Boston's booming, and there's a growing population, and so they needed a new church. And then sort of the elite merchants gathered around Brattle, and Brattle designed what is just an amazing sort of I think it's the first steepled Protestant church in America. And wrote an article about this long, long ago. And a guy named Peter Benes is back in writing about meeting houses now, and he's very good. And we've talked about this, and we go back and whether, you know, which of the churches are. This architecture that Brattle did, Benes certainly agrees with me, is sort of revolutionary. And for those of us who would look at a building and go, wow, you know, that means something. Well, this church meant something. It meant that they were tying into the London churches. They were tying into Episcopalianism. They were tying into the values of middle-class London. And Cotton was wary of that.
Let me just to clarify, before I get to his wariness, this is a church that looks like, to modern minds, a New England church should look like.
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of funny. Yeah.
Yeah. But
it is, it's the absolute normal New England church.
Yeah.
But before that, a church wasn't even called a church. That was sort of in Puritanism, that was not done. It was a meeting house. It's a barn with seats. I mean, that's crude, but it's a little bit better than that, but it's a meeting house. There's a different vision of what makes a place sacred.
Right, which actually has sort of come back within evangelicalism, you know, the desire to sort of diminish the church. The church is the building, and the people are the church, and the building is not the church, is a sort of idea. I'd like to bring up something here, just as a little sidelight to this. Is one of the things, when you have a meeting house, and the meeting house is a meeting house. This is where, you know, it's like a public building where lots of things go on and meetings of various sorts. The pastor does not have an office in the meeting house. And so it goes with the geography issue of if you start to think from the geography of the North End, well, also you start to think from where does the pastor work? The pastor works out of his house. And so the pastoral duties are a type of cottage industry in which the whole family's involved. And so Cotton, as a child, is involved in his father's ministry, and then the mothers and the wives and the sisters and the aunts and uncles. And then in the North End, where the minister's wife is a sort of key figure to look out for all sorts of women's issues. And they're educated, so they're teaching reading and writing to the girls. And the kitchen and the pastor's study are these amazingly vibrant places. And so I try to do that in the book, is to try and keep people always imagining the domesticity of this, the cottage industry of Cotton Mather's life, the integral relationship of his wife and his daughter Katie, especially in his own ministry, is something I tried to do, and I hope I did well. But it takes us out of this sort of myopia about his psychology and worrying about, you know, what's going on in his own mind, and puts us into the life of his household.
Yeah.
He's wary of Brattle Street. Why?
I didn't hear what you said.
You said he's wary of Brattle Street and what it represents.
Brattle Street, yes. Yeah. He's, okay, this is one of the things, too. He's wary of moderation, which most of us would think of moderation as being wisdom. And he would, too, to a sense, but it's like he fears wisdom. He fears moderation. And the Bible's full of this. For the image that constantly gets used is lukewarmness. Is a Christian should be hot and not lukewarm. And so it's not a statement that the Brattle Street Church was in any way unorthodox. No, they're fully Protestant. They believed all the right things, but they just seemed a little too interested in outward show. They were too interested in fine clothes. And then the minister that they picked, Benjamin Coleman, he's actually one of the kids who comes out of Cotton Mather's own youth group. And Benjamin Coleman loves Cotton Mather. But Benjamin Coleman is one of these guys who's maybe a little bit, you know, he'd gone to London and come back with the London fashions and Cotton's worried about him, just as, you know, any pastor would be worried about a kid from the youth group who goes off to the big college and comes back thinking he's a little bit bigger than he should.
He speaks about Eleutherians versus you'll have to take it away.
This is Eleutherian is this word for freedom, and it's this amazingly magical word throughout Western history. The Greeks use it all over the place. The Bible uses it all. The New Testament uses it all over the place. And you know, Paul, using the term Eleutheria, you know, says, you know, Christ has set you free, and for freedom Christ sets you free, and all these sorts of things. And so, freedom. Christianity is about Eleutherianism. It's about being free for Cotton Mather, and he uses that term every once in a while, and he sees that as a key aspect of what I am considering this sort of beginnings of evangelicalism. Is one of the things that when you don't sell Brattle Street's church doesn't sell out to London values, but it's sort of becoming sort of focused on London values, and in being focused on London values, in Cotton Mather's mind, you're giving up freedom. You're giving up your own freedom, and we have to encourage people to be free, free in the gospel, free to be who they should be, and all this other sort of stuff. And this idea that the ultimate freedom, the ultimate happiness, the ultimate joy is something bigger than this moderate London style Episcopalianism. And that's what Cotton Mather comes at Eleutheria all the time. Now, he writes a book called Eleutheria, too, in 1698, in which he specifically does a history of British Protestantism, saying that British Protestantism is ultimately always this pursuit of Eleutheria, a pursuit of being this free church in relationship to Rome and everything else. But you know, there's always this tendency, the devil, sort of a screw tape letter sort of thing, the devil wants each of us to constantly just give up our own freedom and just follow the path of normalcy. And that's what Cotton Mather always is interested in.
But he is like many people of his time in the Anglican, but also in the Congregational and Presbyterian interests. He's interested in sort of Protestant, European Protestant unity, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, very much. And so he's very compromising about what we would call ecclesiology, which is church structure, church offices. You know, is there a bishop or elders or you know, are you a synod? Are you Presbyterian? Are you Congregationalist? Are you Baptist? He would get into those fights sometimes because he does believe Congregationalism is the very best and biblical way to run things. But on the other hand is, hey, it's not that big an issue for him. And so he wants a Protestant unity. And it's part of this Protestant interest. It's going to unite the empire. His ideas of Protestant unity are actually counter to his what I'm calling his evangelicalism. He's always willing to think big and to play to the middle and to hold the unity, and so that was important to him. But on the other hand is he was always calling individuals out of that sort of moderation and unity into something higher, my utmost for his highest type of his life. A trip, you know, there's mere Protestantism, but then he wanted to push everyone to sort of choose to be at the top of Christianity. And so the church structure, that's just part of mere Protestantism. And so he's willing to accept a wide range of that. And he preaches at lots of other churches, and he gets along with a lot of ministers.
So you also suggest that one of the things that makes him the first evangelical is that he is not an elitist, that there is something of a populist in his makeup. Is that part of what makes him so wary of Brattle Street?
Yeah, and just in general, he believes that the gospel is a type of populist message. It's for everybody, and what he preaches can be adopted and taken into the heart by women and children and poor people and blacks and Indians. And he has no interest in really preaching some sort of elitist, theologically correct, point by point, theologically, whatever you want to call it. It's a populist sort of message he puts out there a lot. And even when he goes into the Enlightenment, as an intellectual, he's a leading intellectual. He's always involved in intellectual things. But he has this angle on almost every intellectual issue, which is populist. When he looks at comets, when he studies, he does even the inoculation we talked about last time, or when he looks at medicine, when he looks at politics and social reform and all these things. He's very similar to Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin was one of these kids who venerated the Cotton Mather when Ben Franklin was a teenager. And so there's a lot of similarities between the sort of populism of Ben Franklin and the populism of Cotton Mather.
Huh. That's an interesting point. We'll get back to that in just a second when we talk about projects and projections and good works and stuff like that. You discuss in also some detail Charles Morton's The Spirit of Man and the ideas and the importance of that book, which has to be the most important book that most people, Americans, I mean, even people with graduate degrees have never heard of. It's a really important book, but no one's read it and has tremendous influence too. Describe Morton's book and who was he and what was the spirit
Charles
of man about?
Morton was this guy who shows up. This is the guy Increase Mather venerates. I mean, Charles Morton's like at the top of the Protestant game in London when his academy is shut down by the Bishop of London. And so in 1686, Increase Mather is able to convince Charles Morton to come to America to become president of Harvard. Well, you know, he is too famous to be president of Harvard because that would make Harvard a target for the Bishop of London. So and Morton's a very nice guy, very moderate. So he becomes the minister at Charleston, right across the little ferry, a little rowboat ride from Cotton's house is the house of Charles Morton. And Morton becomes this sort of a man that lots of people go to, the William Brattle, the Thomas Brattle's younger brother, who's at Harvard and very important in Harvard's history, venerates Charles Morton. And Cotton Mather himself just apparently, you know, sits at the feet of Cotton Mather, of Charles Morton. And Cotton Mather writes the introduction to Charles Morton's book, The Spirit of Man, which is this first publication of a psych. It's a first psychology, a full psychological study in America, and it's a very interesting book. It wanders into a lot of different things, but it's fundamentally keeps coming back to sort of sanctification, and that's what Cotton Mather says in the introduction, is because it's about hot spirits and cold spirits and how we have these spirits within us, and the fundamental thing is that he uses the biblical principle that it's not a dualistic spirit and matter. It's not at that time, Cartesian, you know, spirit and matter was the dualism of the day. No, we are not dualistic. We're actually tritheistic. We're triune. We're done in the image of God. And so therefore, Bible tells us that we have a soul and we have matter, but we also have spirit. So soul, spirit, and matter. And so his book is about what this spirit is and how it works within us and our dispositions, and especially ultimately our dispositions to God are wrapped up in this spirit. And so it's a very interesting, and it has very, I don't know of any influence in the history of psychology, but it is very important for Cotton Mather. And I put it in the book as a type of precursor. You know, Jonathan Edwards does this amazing study of psychology in the religious affections. But this is that kind of thing. If you're gonna be thinking about what's going on inside a human being, sort of a spiritual anthropology, this you need to have something like Charles Morton. And so Charles Morton is sort of the intellectual foundation behind Cotton Mather.
So this is another part of his this new American evangelicalism, is this way of analyzing emotions, what Edwards will call affections.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Spirit. What is this thing? What's the nature of sanctification?
Right. How do we become holy?
Right. Yeah. What is actually physically going on? What is tangibly physically going on in our bodies?
Wow. Okay. Morton, he taught at Harvard, even though he wasn't president, correct?
Well, his textbooks were all used at Harvard, and I'm sure he got over there to give a lecture or two, but his politically they found it best to make sure that he was never too important. He was he was a sort of a by name vice president under for a while till he died in 1698, but not really teaching.
So this gets us. This is sort of the next. I chuckled. You describe Samuel Eliot Morison in his History of Harvard breathes a sigh of relief that Cotton Mather never became president of Harvard, and thereby, since he was not president, therefore the Enlightenment came to Harvard. Which apparently means that the Enlightenment was really dull, boring, and not very intellectually active, because that's what happens at Harvard for a period in the early 18th century. So Mather, on the other hand, is much more a bright spark than the people that sort of took over Harvard at that point.
Harvard's job is very clear-cut, and I don't know why Morison doesn't do more with this, but Harvard's job is to lay low. Harvard's job is to not get into anyone's target range, because Harvard's technically illegal under the new charter, and they don't know what it's going to do. You cannot offer degrees that are legal in the British Empire unless you have a charter from the king, and Harvard has no charter from the king, and so they just they're always fearing that the king is going to shut it down. So it's best to put Leverett in charge of it, and then Leverett's a good guy for just laying low, and they have this guy Henry Flint
too much.
Doesn't do much. There's a bunch of both. The best faculty that they are brought in are actually ones encouraged by, like the first science professor, the first professor of mathematics is Greenwood, and Greenwood comes in as a Mather protege. He's one of the kids from Mather's youth group, and Mather promotes him up to be science, the first Hollis professor of science.
So
Harvard is really laying low, and And the thing is that, and I want to point this out, is that Samuel Eliot Morison had something against the Mathers. I venerate Samuel Eliot Morison. I actually am looking at a picture on my wall right now of Samuel Eliot Morison. I wanted to name my sailboat after Samuel Eliot Morison, but the trouble was I got too small of a boat, and I didn't think it was worthy of Samuel Eliot Morison. So Samuel Eliot Morison is like the great figure, man, for me. But the thing is, boy, did he hate the Mathers. Just read his work, and the guy just, like, I don't know what the Mathers get into his craw, and he just can't stand either of them.
Well, but what this means is, in a way that Morison didn't latch on to, and frankly, a lot of people still aren't always too clear about, is that the Enlightenment kind of enters into Boston through Cotton Mather's study.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He's the one who writes the big science books and he's the big promoter.
And how is he? I mean, here we've got a guy who, well, as we talked in the last podcast, was, you know, well, certainly he's usually thought of as the chief promoter and inquisitor of the Salem witch trial. We've disposed of that myth, but. How can this guy, this witch finder, this guy who believes in witches and demons, how can you call him a representative of the Enlightenment?
Okay, first of all, we have to understand that there's lots of different types of Enlightenment. This is one of those historian words which we apply, and I point out in the book, and you know, there's the Scottish Enlightenment, there's Catholic Enlightenments, there's all sorts of different types of biblical Enlightenments, so what I did with Mather was, and like you do a nice job, they're saying the Enlightenment comes through his study. Is because there's basically three types of Enlightenment that we usually talk about. One is political, and it has to do with, you know, rights that lead to the Declaration of Independence and all that sort of stuff. The other is scientific, and then the third is the Bible's authority. You know, is the Bible going to be an authority? And Cotton Mather is probably the first important American to realize that there is a sort of battle for the Bible's authority going on. So in this very early beginnings of the Enlightenment, he is actually in his Biblia Americana out to defend the Bible, and to do so in a way that is very sophisticated, he is not some sort of like, I'm going to build a defense wall and fight the world with the, he's where does the Bible engage the world today? You know, how does it engage the new science? How does it engage with, and he's always constantly showing that the Bible still retains its authority while it engages this new vibrant Enlightenment as it's coming in. Like Spinoza and those other guys, he really doesn't want to do he wants to do the opposite of that. Now, and then with the politics, you know, I connected it into Ben Franklin. Cotton Mather is writing much about the responsibilities of political life and freedom and justice issues and humanitarian issues, and he's very interested in religious freedom for Jews, and he's very interested in how we're going to have political relationships with the Indians. He's out for a diverse and new society in which he believes fully in egalitarianism. He believes that the slaves are equally human beings. Now, he has a different role. He believes in slavery, but slaves are equally human with us because God has created us all human in Adam, and we all sin together as human beings. So he has this view of, he has a very distinct and Christian ways of doing politics and egalitarianism, freedom, all this humanitarianism, very distinct ways to look at the Bible as a vibrant authority, and then very distinct ways of doing his science, and as we talked about last time with the inoculation and such. So he's engaged at every level of the what's coming and what we see coming with the Enlightenment, but he's doing so with a very interesting perspective, which just comes out of his Bible perspective.
So part of also the Enlightenment was projects. Back then, an entrepreneur is called a projector. And Mather has a passion for projects, just like Daniel Defoe and just like Benjamin Franklin. Defoe's, I guess, almost his exact contemporary, come to think of it.
Daniel Defoe, by the way, went to the school, if I'm saying this correctly, went to the academy that was founded by Charles Morton.
Well, it's, wow. Okay, it's a small. The 17th century is great like that. Everyone runs into each other some one way or the other. So, what's the spirit of projects projecting and sort of pious good works, improving the lot of fellow man, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, this is. Cotton wrote several different things. The one, the most famous one, is called the Boston Ebenezer, which is in the. It appeared reprinted in the Magnalia Christi Americana. But these are things which really inspired what later becomes Benjamin Franklin's Do Good projects and stuff. And especially to get small groups of people. Remember Ben Franklin's Junto? Get a group of people reading together, and you know we can change ourselves and change the world. And Cotton Mather believes the same thing. He's all the time forming these small groups, and they do these things. So there's this sort of projector, this constant entrepreneurial activity of creating groups of people, and then especially then with the Boston Ebenezer, he wants to talk about everybody's duties, and so all your different political duties in society, you have to live them, and you do them by their, you know, responsibly. A judge is so important, a school teacher is so important, a police officer is so important. So all of these different people have to be working together in concert. And so just as Ben Franklin, you know, later does things like create libraries and fire departments and stuff like that. Ben Cotton Mather's doing similar types of stuff very early on. Cotton Mather's amazingly energetic. It is just
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, he really is. It's tiring to read about him. I don't know what it's like to write about him. But it really makes me it makes me want to smash my computer and pay more attention to doing some other things rather than looking at screens. We're just about out of time. But so he dies just 5 years after his father. What is his immediate legacy in Boston and in New England? I mean, the Second Great Awakening is just about to walk on stage.
The First Great Awakening, yeah.
First Great Awakening, awful personification. Jonathan Edwards is emerging as when Mather is, those last 5 years of his life. What's his immediate legacy?
Well, I would say his immediate legacy was as this pastor scholar, this person of great piety and leadership and a model to everything, and a person, you know, when he died, man, everyone comes out for his burial, and then this biography is immediately published, which I talked about last time, by his son, which is culls all this stuff in the diary, and everyone's reading it, everyone's thinking about Cotton Mather. The pastor who takes over his position, named Joshua Gee, you see later things in the Great Awakening where he is talking about Cotton Mather as the venerable Cotton Mather, and Cotton Mather's granddaughter gets involved in the revolution. I talk a little bit about her, and she's a fascinating figure. She's the first person who writes on women's rights and publishes on women's rights in America. Is Hannah Mather Coulter, I think is her last name. I just forgot her last name, but she's an amazing figure. And there's a political scientist named Botting up at Notre Dame who's written a bunch on her, and she's really fascinating. And so there's this legacy that's very it was a neighborhood thing. And so the people who knew him, the people who remembered seeing him, the people who had heard him preached, man, that sort of spread. And then later on in his life, in the 19th century, there were big fights over what the Congregationalists should look like and stuff like that. Cotton Mather often gets attached, like he did to the witch trials. He gets attached to certain positions. And so he's constantly being debated.
As Congregationalism is going through its great transition to Unitarianism, or parts of it are, as that big movement's being made, Cotton Mather is being used as a sort of representative of all that's wrong about Congregationalism.
Yeah, by those who don't like, who want to go the Unitarian route and want to go various other routes, and then that he's being used as the model of everything right about Congregationalism for people who want to uphold him. That's several of the biographies. They're very clearly that in the 19th century, and then there's this one put out in, that I really like in the late 19th century, put out by the Congregationalist Sunday School publishing house. And you know, Cotton Mather is sort of this talisman. He's sort of this person we uphold, and we either hate him or love him. And that sort of tradition starts real quick, because as the fights over, you know, Great Awakening, old, you know, new, and later on the 19th century, and then later on with the universities and rationalism, Cotton Mather keeps being held up as something we either really want to follow or something we really want to get rid of.
So the man, the scholar, pastor in his study in the North End, walking around, seeing the sick, all that disappears, and there's only a symbol.
Yeah, and that's sort of the sad thing, and that's what I've, if anything, I hope to just put some life back into the guy, you know, breathe some breath into him, because he is such a fascinating and interesting and just a good guy. You know, there's a lot of people in history that I read about and enjoy that I wouldn't want to have dinner with, but Cotton Mather is a guy I would love to sit down and have dinner with.
Well, I have to say, I never thought that before I read your book, I never thought that I would say that about Cotton Mather, but I came away thinking exactly that sort of thing. He sounds tremendously engaging. I used to be suspicious of the idea that Franklin looked him up when he came back to Boston, but now I see why. Of course you would. You would, if you could have a conversation with Cotton Mather, you would. So Rick Kennedy, thanks so much for joining us and illuminating this really fascinating man.
Well, thanks for asking me, and this is a great opportunity, and I really appreciate it.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.